Beyond the Mic with Sean Dillon.
We're joined on the star line by a lawyer, prosecutor, writer, amateur painter, and Seamus Award finalist author. Last time she stopped by, we talked about what meets the eye. Today, she's back with her second novel, Burn This Night. We welcome Alex Kenna.
Thank you for having me.
Alex, let's go beyond the mic. Like in What Meets the Eye, you move in and out of alternating timelines, character to character. Why does this writing style appeal to you?
I think it gives you a fresher way to kind of present the story. I think sometimes if you're trying to solve a murder mystery, if everything is, you know, interviewing people about what happened in the past, it's all kind of, one degree removed. And as a trial lawyer, it's kind of, you think about presenting evidence in the most compelling way, and you want it to be as direct as possible. So, you know, why have somebody describe how they witnessed a murder if you can just jump in there and, you know, just tell people how the murder happened and put people behind the scenes?
Kate Miles is back, flawed as always, but now living with her mom. What was the one thing you wanted to achieve with Kate's story?
I was thinking a lot about families when I was writing the book, and I wanted to... with her mother and her kind of relationship going back and forth, I was interested in writing two people who are both good people and who, you know, love each other, but are just not connecting and not communicating and are just kind of operating on different wavelengths. So that was kind of one element there. And then in this story, Kate learns pretty early on that the man who raised her wasn't her biological father, which is obviously a total shock in your mid-30s, and then kind of discovers indirectly through a DNA website that she's distantly related to a cold case killer. And that was kind of a really interesting process, because I started researching what it's actually like when people make that kind of discovery. And because of these DNA websites, it happens all the time. And there are a lot of podcasts out there where people tell their story. And, you know, I keep wanting to say Mind, F-U-C-K, but then I remember I can't say that. But the complete and total shock that people experience, and kind of how it's like all of a sudden reality shifts a little bit. So that was something that I really delved into in the book to try to, make sure that it read as authentic.
How would it feel if this happened to you? And would you feel comfortable if your DNA in a database?
Sure. I mean, I haven't done 23andMe or any of those websites, but I mean, for law enforcement purposes, I'm not very sentimental. You know, if one of my immediate relatives killed people, that would be a total shock. But if it was like a third cousin, I'd be like, oh, you know, we don't share that much DNA. You know, there's a black sheep in every family. So yeah, if I've got a murderer out there, I'd be happy to help out.
As a prosecutor, you should.
Yeah, that's fair. I actually might have one. I did go a little bit of an ancestry.com deep dive, and I have like a great-great-grandmother who had like a lot of husbands who died mysteriously kind of young.
Wow.
Yeah, great-great or great-great-great, I forget which. But, you know, there were some overlaps. I didn't see that many divorce documents, so it's distinctly possible that I got a kind of a low-grade black widow in the family tree.
Quote, Miles, when this is all over, unquote, Luke was so key to book one. Why was it hard or easy to sideline him in book two?
Well, I just, this is, it's probably where my background kind of gets in the way, because I really like him. He may come back to her and be a part of her story in the future. But realistically, they couldn't fool around if there's an ongoing criminal case. And so, you know, the writer in me wants to be like, oh yeah. And then they, you know, went to a tropical paradise together. And then the prosecutor in me is like, no, that's misconduct. They can't do it. You'll ruin the trial. So I think that probably got in the way. But I was instructed by some readers the last go round that Kate had to get down with someone in book two. So I did my best to accommodate that request.
Why does Kate just find danger?
Well, you know, it's like I recently got a question on a panel about PI books and you know, how do you keep putting in murders when realistically, you know, private investigators are working on things that are a lot more normal. But I think part of it is you need it because that's what people want to read. That makes a compelling narrative. And I think the trick is to write it in a way that's believable. And I think also there's a little bit of her personality that kind of craves adventure and high stakes and a little bit of risks. Like she's mostly responsible, but there's a touch of adrenaline junkie in there too.
Mostly responsible. You're back and you know what time it is. Alex Kennett, author, joins us beyond the mic, and it's time for the Rocky Nate 8 Random Questions Answer with the first thing that comes to your mind. There is no pressure.
Got it.
If it pleases the court, will the Christmas wreath stay up year-round?
Oh, it's up forever. Yeah, my three-year-old won't let me take it down. We look like hoarders if you see our front door. I asked if I could take it down for Halloween, and he said it stays until we're all dead. So up it stays.
Has it become the holiday wreath?
It's pretty much the Christmas wreath. Yeah, he's really bitter that Christmas only happens once a year. So this is our accommodation.
Best thing about your sons?
They're totally different. The oldest one, he's really creative, really smart, and really verbal. But man, he was a hellacious demon as a baby. So number two, best thing about him is that he sleeps and he's not a demon.
One demon child, one normal child. What's your favorite caffeine transmission device?
An entire pot of coffee from yesterday that I've added ice to.
Interesting.
Yeah, you make it, you stick it in the fridge, and then you have, you know, unglamorous iced coffee by the potful.
How about the last book you read?
What is the last book I read?
Well, you have a bunch of them behind you.
Yeah, it's like every time anybody asks me about a book, I have this glitch in my head, and it goes off, and it's like you'd think I'd never read a book in my life. What is the last book I read? I recently read, I'm telling you, it's like you'd think I'd never read anything. I Here in the Dark by Megan Lucas. I'm actually halfway through, but which I have to do a plug because, man, that woman is brilliant, and man, that woman is dark. So, you know, if you're okay with a lot of death and a lot of depression, like, you've never read anything like it. So I'll go with the one I'm halfway through.
Best memory at BoucherCon?
Well, there's just, you know, meeting people and talking to writers and probably just the weirdness of the situation.
Why?
We were in the hotel, was this like crystal biosphere in Nashville, and they were kind of simultaneously hosting like a murder writer convention and like a Southern teen beauty queen convention. And the hotel is so big that there's a moat going through it with boat rides. And there's a steakhouse that was kind of shaped like a plantation, which is not like a good memory, but it did add to like the creepiness vibe. So I think just the kind of feeling of like leaving two small children behind and feeling like I'm hallucinating from sleep deprivation because I'm in a crystal palace with a moat and a bunch of Southern teen beauty queens and murder writers. So I'll just go with the whole vibe.
Sounds like someone's going to die at that beauty pageant.
But we can't because there were like 2,000 murder writers. So everybody's sitting here thinking, man, this should be a story. But we can't because we've all read it.
Alex, which was harder to argue as a prosecutor, the Supreme Court or your three-year-old?
Oh, my three-year-old. Oh, hands down. The Supreme Court, at least there's rules. The three-year-old, there's no rules. And he can change the game whenever he wants.
So what was the best case as your son as a judge?
Well, you know, I tried to teach him about the criminal justice system. So we did like a whole hypothetical thing about if somebody stole a toy off the porch. And I was trying to teach him about mercy and, well, you know, what should we give this person? Maybe they stole it to sell it because they didn't have enough money to buy food. And man, like, people think kids are sweet. Like, they are not. He was like, I sentence them to timeouts every day forever.
Timeout every day forever?
Yeah, for stealing a toy. For stealing a toy. And I said, well, don't you think that's a little harsh? And he said, no, they're a thief. If we don't, they will steal again. So, yeah, the milk of human kindness does not run swiftly through his veins.
Call him a hanging canna.
Pretty much.
What's the one thing you will never do? Ever, 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 for all the money in the world.
The one thing I would never do?
Never do.
I mean, I'm pretty broke right now, so I'm trying to think of something. anything that would land me in jail. Because I've been in law enforcement for a decade, and I don't think that would go well for me. So if I could, anything that could, where I would end up in jail, or there would be a strong likelihood of my ending up in jail.
Alex, give me the best metaphor that describes your life.
Oof. Yeah, no, it is difficult, especially because I don't want to do any weather metaphors because there's a lot of that stuff going on. Maybe like a broken garbage disposal.
The book is Burn This Night, and author Alex Kennett joins us beyond the mic for the back half. Alex, do you think Kate is in a prison of her own making?
No, I think I think she's neurotic, but self-aware for the most part. And I don't think she's any more messed up than most of us.
So how do you think Kate has evolved in the second book?
I think she starts hating herself a lot less in Burn This Night. She had, I guess the story sets up, she had been in a terrible car accident and developed a pain pill addiction and lost custody of her daughter. She's trying to get her daughter back, which is continuing in book two. But I think in book one, she hasn't really forgiven herself for that disaster. And I think she's also had to kind of come to terms with not being a police officer anymore and moving into the private investigation sphere. So I think she kind of accepts herself a lot more when in terms of what she's done. But because I'm a sadist, I then had to throw in some kind of head trip and, you know, introduce the fact that her dad wasn't her dad.
Why is family so important to you as a writer and as a person?
I mean, as a person, I mean, it's everything, especially for writers. I mean, the most of us are introverts, and the ones who aren't introverts are all, you know, bestsellers because they, you know, they can do the hustle. But, you know, and then that when you're, especially when you're an introvert, that's what it comes down to. It's, you know, the few people in your life who count the most, I think. And then as a writer, it's what's central to most people's lives. It's what's central to most people's identity. You know, I think romance kind of gets overplayed as a motive, and it kind of gets overplayed as, you know, something that defines a person. Like, it's nice, but, you know, after a while, we're not all, you know, 24 and horny anymore, right? I mean, it's, you know, there are so many other things that factor in. And I think family becomes much more important in terms of a character's motivation and how a character defines themselves.
There's so many writer's tropes that you could pick from, but what is the most underplayed writer's trope today?
Underplayed tropes? I think we need more unglamorous women and more evil women. I think especially in crime writing tropes, you get a lot of you know, really grizzled 50-year-old alcoholic men. And, you know, they became a womanizer because of the one who got away when she went, you know, 30 years ago, maybe she died. But, you know, women all have to be like a strong woman in a very kind of flawless, admirable, usually a little bitchy kind of way. So I think you need more relatable, but unglamorous women. You need more funny women, and you need more female villains. Like, I love me a good female villain. Like, kill, you know, bring her, make her grizzled, knock out a few teeth, let her kill someone. And you just don't see that nearly enough.
Quote, a little then charming acquaintance has inspired a fictional character, but I can't decide if they should kill or be killed, unquote. Which did you decide?
I think they might have to come out, unfortunately. I think the story might be better without them. And if they go back in, they might just have to go to jail. I don't think I can kill them.
No.
Yeah.
Why?
It just didn't work with the story, but I'll find something to do to them. Something unglamorous. Something sadistic. It'll happen.
Alex, why does writing soothe your creative itch?
It doesn't have to be writing. It's just anything creative. It has to be writing or painting because I'm not musical, but it's just a different part of your brain. And, you know, the periods of my life where I haven't had time to either write or paint, it's just like there's a part of me that's missing. And it kind of lets your brain go down all kinds of crazy avenues. Like in Burn This Night, we had been staying in this tiny town while my house was being worked on. And we saw these really terrible wood carvings. And I thought, huh, I wonder who made those. Huh, I wonder if he's hot. I think I'll make him a love interest. You know, maybe he'll also play the violin. And, you know, maybe this other thing will happen. And, you know, it lets your mind kind of go in crazy, loopy ways that you don't really get to do as an adult, I think, in a lot of other contexts.
Alex Kinna. Her book is the powerful Burn This Night, and she joins us beyond the mic. Do you storyboard, outline, index card? I mean, how do you organize your writing?
Most of the time, it's more kind of, I have like a general idea, or sometimes I'll have an idea of a character and want to kind of build something around the character and then just kind of start stream of consciousing it until it becomes real, or grabbing a legal pad and scrawling on it like a crazy person, and then things, ideas start flowing. But I've been forcing myself to outline because, you know, kid number two entered the picture, and, you know, time is a luxury. And it's, right now I'm working on two books at once, and one is like a total, you know, splatter painting of ideas. And then the other one, I was like, well, what if I try to make an outline? And, you know, I've heard tell that this is a good idea. And it was like an epiphany went off, like, oh, this is so logical. So I'm going to try to become a born again outliner, but we'll see how it goes.
Now, are you a very fast writer? Do you write slow or somewhere in the middle?
I write super fast, but then I'm an obsessive editor. And I'll go over the same sentence like a lunatic for like hours.
How does that work for you?
Well, I shouldn't say the same sentence for hours, but like the same paragraph or the same passage. I have to hear it. I can't write with noise. So I can't write if my kids are running around. I can't write with music. I have to hear everything in my head. And then sometimes things don't sound right. And then if a word doesn't sound right, it has to go. If I used a word, you know, the sentence before, it's got to go. So I just have to hear it and hear how it sounds. So I edit obsessively, but also miss every single typo. So unfortunately, I don't have that gift.
So who does Kate Miles sound like? I mean, which actress should play her?
I was thinking if I wanted to, either Jessie Buckley, who I think can do anything, or I'm blanking on her name, but the actress from Severance, if you've seen it, which is, one, or depending on whether you want to go like a little bitchier or a little softer. But yeah, I would be over the moon either way.
In world creation, when you're creating a world like the Kate Miles world, what are your non-negotiables?
I have to be really interested in all of the characters of any significance. Like if you're suddenly going to introduce somebody like, you know, this person's going to be the parent, I don't let myself kind of just do the lazy approach of plugging somebody in with three descriptors, which is probably why I like to do things from multiple perspectives. And if I'm going to kill someone, I feel like I owe them, you know, I owe it to them to really flesh them out and give them some dimensions, and usually give them at least a chapter or two, especially if I'm going to kill women, and especially beautiful women. Because we talked about tropes. There's always the, like, a dead blonde was found, but, you know, dissected in the subway station. But like, if I'm going to kill somebody, then, you know, they have to be well-rounded. They have to have their own motivations and whatnot. So that's, in terms of like a main character, they got to be somewhat demented. Like, I tried to write a normal person. I quit when they were like stress cleaning the kitchen. It was awful. So like, they got to be at least somewhat neurotic with something a therapist could probably diagnose, or I can't write them
yet. You focused on art in your first book. What is something new that you'd like to work on as a hobby?
I've gotten pretty interested in horse racing. So I'm working on something involving, because I live right by a racetrack. So I've been working on something involving horse racing, especially, you know, every parent knows you get really desperate to entertain your kids. So it's the weekend and I'm like, okay, well, let's go watch jockeys ride horses. And, you know, it's like, I'll take him to watch the jockeys warm up. And it's like me, my kid, and like a bunch of gamblers. But it's a totally fascinating world. It's like you know, you can take a tour and go into the back stretch, and, you know, there's like goats back there to keep the horses company, and all the paint is peeling off, and it's like kind of like gross and disheveled back there. But you have this, you know, this whole glamorous aspect to the, you know, the front stretch. I've gotten really into horse racing, and I think like my weirdest moment was I went one day when I was like 9 months pregnant to like just go watch the races. And, you know, I was diabetic when I was pregnant, and I was like stopping to test my blood sugar, and there's like a 70-year-old gambler next to me who's like also testing his blood sugar, and we just kind of like nod at each other. And so I'm like, okay, this is pretty macabre. But horse racing, I've been on a bit of a kick for a little while.
Do you have a tip for the seventh race? I mean, I could hear the tip now. Well, the gray one's pretty.
Oh yeah, no, he's got his imaginary horse who he cheers for, and everybody, he's like, "Let's go, Bella." He was not an actual racehorse, and you know, everybody else is cheering for someone, so I figure, why not?
How has your writing evolved since your first novel to today?
I think probably you get more of an instinct for what a story needs. Where I think when I first started out, it was kind of like you tell a story and you build all these pieces, and it took a lot longer to kind of figure out what needed to be chipped away and what needed to be added. And now it's you have a sense of, okay, well, this is the pacing you need. You need an introduction that's really going to grab people. Okay, well, the middle needs to be this part. So I think in some ways it's gotten easier, and in some ways it's gotten harder, but I think that probably helps. And then I've tried to simplify a little bit and go off on fewer tangents. But I think the biggest thing I learned is when you first start writing, you assume that a reader is going to remember everything. And then after a while, you're like, no. So now I try to write for like a really busy person who's listening to it in the audiobook in LA traffic, where like they're going to tune out 20% of the book because people are busy and some, jerk off just cut them off. And they're screaming at them, So I want enough road rage to happen, and yet they can still follow the story, but at the same time that the story is smart enough that they don't feel like they're being cheated.
Alex Kenna, author of Burn This Night, joins us beyond the mic. You sold your first book without an agent. What did you learn from that experience?
That I got really lucky for book one. It was like being struck by lightning, because it's like, I think the best example is like one of my guilty pleasures is The Voice. Because, it's like super uncool, but like, whatever, everybody wants to sit there and tear up when someone's dream's being granted. But you realize, you sit there and you watch these auditions and you're like, man, all these people are so freaking talented. They all deserve a recording contract. How do you pick? And you're just like, oh, there's just so much talent out there. And that's kind of what it's like with writing. I mean, I don't know how you pick something out of a slush pile. I mean, there are the people who are like, oh, well, you're a genius, obviously. But for like the rest of people, there's a lot of talent out there. And it's somebody happened to have read my original pitch. And I think that person happened to be into painting. So, if the baseball guy had been reading the slush pile on that particular day, then, that would have been a no.
Alex, what changed the most from your first draft of Burn This Night to the final hardback?
Well, someone came back from the dead. So that was a big one. I have a lot less of one character, a lot more of another, and it got less bleak. Like I have one character in, there's a few chapters from his perspective who slowly destroys his mind with meth. And which is the story that I wanted to tell. I think it's important. Like, I live in Los Angeles. We have a massive epidemic of brain damage because the meth crisis is horrific. And there's not a lot of coverage on it because it doesn't have the same fatality level as fentanyl. So that was something that I really kind of wanted to tell. And it was a challenge as a writer to go through, to write somebody whose mind is deteriorating. But originally I had a lot of that. And I think a little goes a long way. And I think that character got scaled back quite a bit. So I don't want to say I'm like punctuating the story with the meth user destroying their brain, but there's a lot less of that. And I think it makes the story as a whole stronger.
As a prosecutor, how does cold cases make you feel?
I worked briefly on one cold case when I was a DA, but not much. That hasn't been a ton of my experience, but, certainly the idea of working on them is very interesting if something new comes to light, and finally being able to bring justice to the families of people who haven't had that, and to try to bring answers. So I think it's definitely an intriguing area, and especially with advances in forensic technology. But right now I'm more on the white collar end of the spectrum, so probably not a lot of cold cases coming my way in the near future.
Now, how does your husband support you other than keeping the kids from coming in and saying, "Mom, what you doing?"
Oh, no, he's the best. Like he does honestly more than half the housework and child rearing. He makes time so that I can write on the weekends. When I went to BoucherCon, I left him alone with a 3-year-old and a 6-week-old for 5 days. And you know, I'd call him and he'd just be like, I'm so tired. I'm just so tired. And, you know, I'm like, that's cool. I'm going to go have another margarita, but I'll see you in 4 days. So adios. But,
love you.
Yeah. I'm very, very lucky. And I can't complain at all. And he's also my reader in my reader of my books. He's an appellate attorney and he's one of the best writers I know. And he gives it to me straight. Like I had one character who I was in love with and he was like, she's a huge beast. And I was like, she's not. She's just honest. He's like, no, go read that chapter again. She's a total B. Everyone will hate her. And then I read it again. I'm like, okay, that's accurate. You know, but getting kind of unvarnished advice from somebody who can write and someone who's a huge reader is priceless.
It's the one person who annoyed you that you scaled back. Just admit it.
No, I liked this one. But the one person who annoyed me might have to come out. I'm still on the fence.
It's time for one big question with Alex Kenna on the mic. Alex, what is your dream and when will you know when you get there?
Honestly, I just want to keep doing what I'm doing, but with a lot more money. So, you know, if I can still have an interesting job and write books and my kids are healthy and safe and, you know, also have enough money to buy fancy cheese. That would be a dream.
What do you consider fancy cheese?
You know, anything that smells like a moldering corpse. Yeah. I would like to keep being able to write books, my kids to continue being healthy, and I would like moldy cheese money.
Moldy cheese money and margaritas.
And a margarita, but not at the same time. Maybe a really good red.
She's got a black widow in her family, has one normal but one demon child, loves iced coffee, and wants you to read Burn This Night. Alex Kenna, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And that, my friends, is Beyond the Mic. If you're enjoying these conversations, please check out another Beyond the Mic episode to find more actors, artists, and people you need to know. We'd also appreciate a like and subscribe on the Good Pods app.